And we're back. Welcome to another episode of the Schools and Academy Show podcast.
Once again, we're going to be focused on the one topic this month, as it's not every day news from the education sector breaks out into the mainstream news.
No prizes for guessing that we're going to be talking about RAC today. While to a layperson, reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete might not sound like the most exciting topic, I think we all know it's causing a lot of headaches in schools. Well, probably more like migraines, actually.
Before we jump in, we should probably make sure that we're all on the same page about what RAC actually is. As Sam mentioned before, RAC stands for Reinforced Autoclaved Aerated Concrete. And at the risk of greatly oversimplifying things, it's a lightweight concrete made with fine aggregate, as opposed to coarse aggregate like normal concrete.
RAC looks like an aero bar, full of pockets of air, but cracks like a crunchy bar, and can even become crumbly to the touch. Sort of like a flake, especially as it reaches the end of its serviceable life, which is expected to be about 30 years.
Now, I know we all like to refuse to acknowledge the passing of time, and it feels like 30 years ago was the 70s. But it's important to remember that 30 years ago was actually the early to mid 90s, which is concerning, not just because it's a stark reminder that it's 2023, but because buildings were being built with RAC as far back as the 1930s.
So how did we get here? Well, according to The Independent, in 2017, a school roof collapsed without any prior signs of decay, prompting the Standing Committee on Structural Safety to investigate RAC.
While it's not clear which school's roof collapsed in 2017, we do know that another roof collapsed in 2018 at Singwell Primary School in Kent, which prompted Kent Council to write to other local authorities, warning them to check for RAC in their schools.
In 2019, a structural engineer investigating on behalf of the Standing Committee began to frequently encounter RAC that wasn't fit for purpose and suggested that all RAC installed before 1980 needed to be replaced.
Now, the government have published guidance for schools about the need to have adequate contingencies in place for the eventuality that RAC-affected buildings need to be vacated at short notice. But the information for schools applying for the grants for construction improvement around funding said that not all RAC is dangerous.
As time went on, though, this tune soon changed, and in 2021, the Department for Education regarded the risk of a building fatally collapsing as, quote, critical and very likely, which are just not the words you ever want to hear, really, is it? And in 2022, they sent a survey to the responsible bodies to assess if their school contained RAC in any way.
Fast forward to 2023, and you may remember that we spoke about RAC earlier this year. Back in June, the National Audit Office announced that roughly 700,000 pupils were learning in a school that the responsible body, or the DfE, believes needs major rebuilding or refurbishment. And on August the 31st, days before the school's return for the new academic year, the DfE updated its guidance around RAC, which meant that more than 100 schools had been told to close some of their buildings. And in some cases, schools needed to close altogether. In light of this, the DfE have also provided a caseworker to each school affected by RAC.
What triggered this sudden change was that earlier in the year, there had been cases where RAC had given way or failed without notice. Engineers have rated the severity of RAC from critical, meaning it requires immediate action with rooms, blocks or entire buildings being shut down, to high, medium or low.
Schools have been advised to use temporary classrooms and nearby empty local office buildings, amongst other solutions, when they've needed to relocate their provision.
As you can imagine, needing to deliver lessons in different settings or move premises altogether will not be cheap, and as a kicker, this won't be funded by capital funding. Although capital funding will cover mitigating the risks of RAC, any extra costs incurred from moving teaching to a different location will need to be covered by the school and their reserves. The DfE has advised schools to discuss this with their caseworkers and the Education and Skills Funding Agency.
It's not hard to figure out that this is a story, and its impact on school estates has huge implications on every aspect of school life, all the way down from teaching to safeguarding. So, to help us investigate, we'd like to introduce our guest today, Stuart McGregor, Head of Operations from the National Association of School Premises Managers. Stuart, welcome to the podcast. Could you please introduce yourself to our audience, let them know a bit about yourself, your role within the sector and your organisation?
Yeah, so I'm Stuart McGregor. I am the head of the National Alliance of School Premises Managers, a chartered member of IOSH for over 20 years. Background looking after local authority schools for over 20 years, managing sort of compliance in schools, consultancy in schools, and a lot of sort of health and safety management systems all around the sort of education and specific areas around different types of schools, whether it's a school nursery, primary school, or secondary school.
Perfect. Thank you for joining us, Stuart. We really appreciate you coming along today to help us pick your brains a little bit on this situation. So I guess we'll start with the health and safety implications of RAC. So RAC has led to partial or complete closure of over 100 schools in England now. How does the deterioration of RAC in school buildings impact established health and safety procedures within these educational environments?
Yeah, this is a very challenging and complex situation that the schools are in. So it potentially, in terms of what the findings are, there is a significant impact for those that have got RAC within the building. And the first thing that you'd consider being a school is what are the current health and safety procedures within the school environment? And that's basically looking at the health and safety policy and their arrangements. So when you start looking at that sort of health safety management, it's a legal duty under the Health and Safety at Work Act and all the other related regulations that may come into play. So, you know, looking at the key sort of impact areas would be starting with the risk assessment. Within their health and safety policy, schools have a duty to ensure that they've got a risk assessment for anything that's significant. Well, this is classed as significant if the schools have got RAC in their building. So that is a huge sort of review to start off and actually a good indicator of what needs to be done first. But then what else has been sort of evolving from this is around, you know, the initial thing of you need to close an area or even close a school or close a part of the building, like you said before, partial or complete closure. But then actually, what does that mean for the building management and the statutory compliance of the building? For example, gas management, Legionella, electricity management, all that sort of statutory compliance that the school has a duty to ensure they're doing could be affected by the RAC issue, by having, for example, closure of a building, closure of a hall, for example, and you can't get in to sort of use the facilities or manage the Legionella control measures. So yeah, it is that concern. Another huge concern is the fire safety. Fire safety around the management of the fire safety risk assessment. You know, any changes in the building in terms of change of use or change of sort of structure or, you know, change of fire safety evacuation procedures. If you're losing a room, losing a corridor, losing a hall, the fire risk assessment should be reviewed and all that sort of stuff that then leads on to other areas of building management. For example, the security implications, the sort of specific classroom areas. So if you've got a classroom that, you know, closing off one classroom may be okay. But if that classroom is a special educational needs classroom that's been specifically designed, that got hoists and other sort of equipment for the children, and you're closing that classroom, that would have a huge impact on trying to relocate areas of the school as well. Other implications include school meals. If you're losing the dining hall or sections of the building, how the school ensure that they're managing their statutory provision of providing school meals. And also the food safety implications, you know, changes in locations of servery, making sure that the food is at temperature and the sort of delivery of food is okay. Contractor management is a massive issue at the moment because there's a lot of contractors coming in and out of school, surveying areas, working at height, bringing in vehicles onto the site. And the other big implication that I've seen is the welfare, you know, losing a toilet facility, losing a first aid room, which is a requirement for schools to have. That sort of welfare that you take for granted, if you're losing a section of the school, how would the school ensure that they've got provision for that? So, you know, reviewing the whole sort of building and what support's required. Another area of concerns is the decanting, moving items around the school, which causes issues around manual handling. Emergency services is another key one around the school's duty to ensure that they provide their emergency services coming into the building, information on significant hazards. So, you know, how do they give that information in the event of a fire, a fire brigade turning up and the school's got RAC within their hall, for example, and it becomes a weak structure, the fire brigade should be aware of that on point of contact into the school. So having like a firebox on the entrance to say, look, hazards in the school actually include rachna in addition to other known hazards. Other implications include sort of letting arrangements where they've having to close areas of the school and then trying to rearrange different areas and locations for the lettings to sort of use. So there is that huge implication. I think the initial thing is we need to make sure, schools need to make sure that they've actually closed off areas, but that's just the start of it. That's just the initial risk of removing that hazard of something, of the rack falling and collapsing and causing harm. But then what about everything else in terms of that risk, the knock-on effect of losing that and that area? So it's very difficult and very complex, and every school is different.
Following up on that, could you potentially provide some insights into how schools can ensure their health and safety procedures and protocols are robust enough to address the challenges posed by issues like RAC and preventing possible future safety hazards?
Yeah, I think it's a key question. And also to consider, first off, that, you know, these schools were designed at that age, you know, between 1950s and 1990s. And any school that's designed, built, is designed to approve standards. So in terms of, you know, ensuring that schools are following procedures to address these sort of issues, first off, is actually that the buildings have been designed to a specification, a sort of a sign-off. It all comes back to the risk profile of the school estate, and every school site is different. You could go from a one-form entry with 8 classrooms, one small hall and a staff room, to a secondary school with 14 buildings, you know, a huge estate, and different ages of buildings, you know, schools that have got buildings from the 1880s, 1800s, early 1900s, right up to sort of new buildings. So in terms of building potentially, well, the main point is actually recognising that building can be a risk. So that risk profile, and sometimes that is missed as part of the sort of risk assessment. When you look at the requirements to do a risk assessment, you know, you may start with sort of activities, what they do in schools, but the building in itself, you know, putting that down as the hazard, the building is often missed. So within our association, we've got risk assessments that cover areas of the building, but the building in its entirety, in terms of saying this was built this age, this has got this condition, it's, you know, it's got an older boiler system or an older roof, or it's not compliant to fire safety standards because it's got all fire doors and we need to act. So once you're aware of what you're dealing with in terms of your school estate, you get that picture to say it's based on significant risks and you're actually risk assessing the building. And once you know that in terms of that, and it doesn't have to be difficult, it can be a tabletop exercise with the school leadership team, the premises team, to just look at what you've got and then just seeing what else has been presented in terms of that safety of the building. You know, condition surveys that have been done over the years, asbestos surveys that's been done over the years, fire safety surveys. So there'll be evidence gathering, information gathering that will help the schools to ensure that the building management is to a standard that one is legal, but two, actually there's a proactive input, not just a reactive, something's happened, we need to do something, or it's going to cost X amount of money and we don't want to spend this money, we want to spend it on something else. It's realising from the senior leadership team the profile of the building in terms of that health and safety management to ensure any future potential building safety hazard is assessed at this time, reviewed, and actually there's a risk rating. You know, understanding that this building that could be 1970s that's got asbestos in, for example, you've got a plan to remove it. Or, you know, this building that's 1980s and you've got this rack issue, you know, that's been highlighted now that you need to have this as an urgent action. But again, this has been around coming from the DfE since 2018, so there's been an element of stuff coming through, but it's then how you've actually, the schools and how they react to that, and recognizing the risk involved with, and also the implications of that risk that we, you know, we're seeing there. Who would have foreseen that the schools would have been closing and switching to remote learning? It's that sort of potential recognition of risk, losing a room, losing a building, losing a school. So I always bring it back to the current estate's condition, health and safety building risks, and having an action plan to ensure that you've got that sort of 3-year forecast on a building management, a 5-year forecast. What's the sort of wish list, but what is the building compliance condition and where do you need to be at? Some buildings, some types of rooms, some areas will have a life cycle. They will have a life cycle within the school building, whether it's a piece of equipment, whether it's the flooring, whether it's the roof, whether it's the boiler system. Everything's got a life cycle. So how well that's being managed, you know, I always advise to look at the DfE website and their good estates management. And also on our National Alliance, where we've got our documents that give that sort of template guidance around building compliance and good estates management.
Thanks for that, Stuart. So I want to stick with that idea a little bit as we move on to risk assessments. Now, you mentioned how guidance has been coming through and updated ever since 2018 when we had that first initial wave of roof collapses. And guidance was even updated earlier this year in August. With that in mind, given the evolving nature of the RAC crisis, how can schools adapt their risk assessment processes to stay up to date with new information and emerging best practices in addressing RAC-related risks?
The key point on this one is to consider, you know, what have they done to date? You know, it's not, you know, for me, it's never to assume, and this is the sort of key point really around, you know, have you followed that process to actually where you're at? Because every school's going to be different. We know that there's a number of schools that haven't actually completed surveys. We know schools are coming on board with a more identified RAC. So the first point around this crisis is to ensure that, you know, have you, rather than just assuming that you've done that process, it's having that assurance that if you have RAC, that's the first thing. Have you done the pre-assessment of saying, is it between the 1950s and 1990s? Have you done a visual inspection? Is there any limitations of access that you can't get to visually see? Do you need to get a competent surveyor out to ensure that the school's got a competent professional survey of the RAC? And that's the key point of this one. So addressing that to say, you've got that full assurance that you haven't, or if you have, it's then how you're going to be treating this as the emerging risk. Because adapting a school current risk assessment, I would say a new risk assessment's needed, because this is a new risk. And looking at our National Alliance of School Premises Managers, we completed our template risk assessment for RAC and sent that out to our members on the 3rd or 4th of September. And that really detailed all areas of potential hazards within the school. And that's where they need to be at in terms of identifying the original one of, you need to close. You need to make sure that this area where there's a potential harm of building concrete collapsing, that area is secured and controlled. And that's a key area, because what does closure mean? Does that mean fully closed? Does it mean that premises staff can walk in? Does it mean that contractors can walk in? So that risk assessment will detail that. But it's actually then identifying, you know, that area of saying that's easy to say, well, that's closed, that's eliminated risk, but the impact of the risk and the ongoing development of that and how you imagine, you know, looking at that and making sure that you've got that sort of control measure in place. And then just making sure, you know, being in communication with the right channels, such as the DfE website, HSE website, in terms of updated information. And of course, joining our National Alliance of School Premises Managers, you'll get updated information. We send action notes and newsletters. So it's sort of being in the loop of just being aware of anything that's emerging, because things are changing around this. And I think it's because it's new to schools. I think the risk assessment process is something that needs to be fully adapted to the specific school environment. And I think having that template with the headings to, you know, have you considered this? Have you considered this area? Have you put this into that area? And really just make sure that you've got competent advice within the schools as well, whether or not that's from the employer, whether it's a local authority or whether it's a trust, is ensuring that you've got the competence assurance as well.
So following on from that, this question's a two-parter, so we can answer it in chunks. In terms of risk assessment, how should schools be prioritising addressing RAC-related issues alongside other safety concerns which are constantly present? And on top of that, what advice would you offer to schools or estate staff who are navigating the RAC crisis to ensure that health and safety of students and staff remains a top priority in their setting?
I think it's making sure that being aware of what the risk assessment details in terms of all hazards. And again, it's not just with the RAC in itself, because I think identifying that area of being, you know, an area that's closed, it's then looking at all the other impacts around the health and safety arrangements. So I'll just look back, I'll advise the schools to look at your health and safety policy, look at your current risk assessments, look at your building statute compliance, and how this area of closure, what that means to these, you know, the school, because every school will be different, on managing each individual risk. And I'll just take that as a bullet point at a time. You know, fire safety, how has that affected the school environment in terms of, you know, a corridor that's closed off? It could be that you've had extended travel because now you've lost an exit, or it could be, you know, issues around building risk because you can't go in and flush areas of the water management system, or in terms of management of contractors, where, you know, you can see that there's a lot of activity going on where people come in surveying, and as the months go on, there's going to be big project works, there's going to be a lot of propping works, there's going to be removal of concrete, there's going to be construction works, and it's just making sure that you're aware of and getting guidance around the CDM regulations, because that specifically covers a building works, it's work on the fabric of the building, so it comes under these regulations. And it's really extremely vital that the risk assessment around this is being managed and monitored. You know, it mustn't just be a paper-based exercise. It's got must be practical how the school manage it on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. And it needs to have the senior management involved with, you know, looking at the risk and the risk management, and also making sure that the schools get professional guidance. And that also includes linking with the DfE caseworker, the follow-up survey report, the information. And it is important to note that the DfE are working alongside these schools, and they're trying to get the schools open as quick as possible where it's safe to do so. And a lot of that will still mean that the school will not be quite as it was before for a short period of time. I've seen schools that have had scaffolding, boarding being put in halls to just cover the risk of that ceiling falling. But that means that the hall's going to be given back to the school, but it looks like a building site, you know, and how they're going to be managing that is, well, you can use that hall, not for PE, but you could use that for dining. You could use that hall for assembly, but you just need to have that sort of evolving risk. It's that dynamic risk review, because this is going to be totally different to what the schools have had to deal with in the past. And you can clearly see that every school is quite, you know, different in terms of some areas are going to be very quick and easy to sort of prop. There's going to be some schools that are going to be closed for a set period of time. And it's how you manage your higher risk, vulnerable children and staff, and the sort of stress and the even down to sort of remote working, the DSE set up, and also that well-being take on it as well, you know, being away from the school. And then changes, you know, schools, people don't like significant changes. Numbers, if you're losing an area of the school and all of a sudden you get new modular buildings, I can see in the last couple of weeks there's been schools that have had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different types of modular buildings putting into the playground, how that affects other areas of the school. And again, it's another part of this risk. It's not just about the rack, the concrete in itself being a risk. It's all of this now that's been, it's come from that control, risk control, but it's actually then brought other hazards and other concerns. It could be that numbers of people in an area have exceeded the sort of capacity or the fire safety or the playground areas, or you may have lost your assembly point. What does that mean for your fire safety evacuation? So it's a huge, complex subject to be dealing with. And I think the guidance, you know, you need to be making sure that, are you continuing to be statutory compliant for the building safety management? And the DfE have been good in terms of the caseworker and having that discussion with schools to say, look, I've got this area, we've got this area that's taken over our plant room, we still need to do our electrical service checks and gas, annual gas checks, you know, how do we do this? Everything's based on risk, but again, it's just making sure that you've got that awareness to say, rather than just saying, right, close this area, we don't have to worry about that. It's actually, we're going to close this area, but what are the health and safety implications from closing this area? And is the school still legally compliant? What other risks have been brought in terms of health and safety to the children and also to the staff? And other risks that may, you know, may schools may not have considered before, you know, new scaffolding areas that they may look at that as a climbing frame, vehicle and traffic movement, compound areas, losing parts of the school building. So, yeah, it's a very difficult one to give sort of specific guidance. It's just an overall health and safety management review. And I think the starting point, which I did on the 3rd of September when I was reviewing this and completing the new risk assessment was, what are the arrangements within the school? What are the health and safety listings within the school in terms of their arrangements from managing buildings to fire evacuation to food safety management? And reviewing each of these arrangements now with that change to the school in terms of the closure, part closure or full closure, and then making sure that you're following the legal requirements to review your risk assessment and update your risk assessment upon any significant changes. And it is significant changes if you've got RAC in the schools. So again, it's that sort of legal point, but also making sure that we don't want anyone to come to school to be harmed. And it's also that process around the duty of care to others. And sometimes that's missed. You could be closing the building, think it's all under control, but actually you could have contractors coming in and out on a daily basis. What considerations have you done? What health and safety review have you done from their information, looking at their risk assessments, their method statements? What information have you given them in terms of inducting them into your building whilst this area of work's being done? So you know, that sort of stuff should already be in the health and safety policy arrangements. But again, it's just a reminder that schools should be aware to just review these key areas of risk.
So we've started to touch on compliance there, and I think it's only right that we finish on that. It's definitely an area which we need to cover today. So again, we'll go for two parts here, which is, how are schools ensuring that they have been compliant with the changing situation in the RAC crisis? And given the potential long-term nature of addressing RAC issues and problems within schools, how are schools incorporating compliance considerations into their strategic planning for infrastructure improvements?
Well, I just go back to that. You know, the schools are very well versed in building statutory compliance from gas, electric, Legionella, fire, all the sort of standards around the building. So in terms of their compliance role, it's just have a review of what impact RAC is having to that school in terms of these areas. And it could be just something simple that, you know, you can't flush this area because it's closed. Or actually, if you've closed the building for a period of time, the risk of Legionella increases significantly. So you would have a opening plan of that building. So it's that awareness of saying, you know, in terms of compliance to the LA Legionella, it's being aware of that. And again, it's going to be different for each school, different environment. So again, I'll just review on your statutory compliance. Within our alliance, we've got a document, number 25, it's called. It's the statutory compliance. It's a full list. So you just go through the full list of understanding what the school is. Every school will have slightly different statutory compliance areas. Some schools will have fire shutters, some will have different parts, different compared to other schools. So it's just making sure that keeping legal, reviewing compliance, and what would you do different? So in terms of fire safety, key areas is for me, out of everything I've looked at and reviewed, is fire safety seems to be a massive impact on this, because closing a section of the building normally means that you're closing off a fire exit. It could be a route through to another area, and then you've had that consideration of changing that. That should really mean that a review of the fire risk assessment is completed following the fire safety order, regulations 2005, to ensure that you're compliant. So all this sort of stuff that you may think, oh, it's, you know, you're managing okay, you're concentrating on this, but you need to think about the wider area. So I'd actually just take a step back to actually say, well, we know we've got this in this area. We know that we've closed this, but what does that mean in terms of compliance and for the school compliance? If there's any issues around compliance, it's taking that professional guidance, whether it's from the health safety competent person, you know, making sure that if there is a concern, a potential compliance breach, that there can be action. And most of the time, what I've seen in terms of the DfE caseworker and assistance and review going back and forth, looking at school risk management, is that there will be based on risk. So it could be that area that needs to have access or egress for whatever reason, whether it's a gas meter, whether it's electrical intake room, whether it's emergency cutoff valve for a sprinkler system, or whatever it is, you need to ensure that it's on a risk-based process, that you are still managing the building compliance based on risk. And what does that mean? It actually means you need a risk assessment, because it's significant and it says what you're doing, and taking guidance as well. And then that way you should be compliant with the building statutory compliance as well.
Well, I'd say that's just about all the questions I have for today. So with that, we can draw this interview to a close, Stuart. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been fantastic to get insight from you on this situation, as it is now something that is bleeding through every aspect of school life. Every consideration that schools make now must be viewed through the lens of RAC in their setting and the crisis it's creating. So it's really important that we're able to get conversations with people like yourself and able to help school leaders who follow the podcast. Just before we go, I'd like to ask, is there anything you'd like to say to our audience before you go, potentially about your own work or things that you've got upcoming?
Yeah, I just, you know, can't stress enough around the requirements around risk and risk management. It shouldn't be a paper-based exercise. It needs to be a practical process of ensuring that you can take that hazard and put in the risk control measures, and it means something for the staff and those affected. So it's not just about a paper-based exercise. It's a practical. And yeah, and for our National Alliance of School Premises Managers, you know, it's a great tool to assist. Our focus and mission was to give schools the ability to have guidance, templates, documents, and to get on board with sort of CPD training in terms of premises staff, and to really sort of support the schools in their good estate management and their health and safety management system. So yeah, thanks for today. It's been really good to speak to you.
Perfect. Again, Stuart, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon in the future. Well, I get the feeling that this probably isn't going to be the last we hear of RAC, and we'll be sure to keep you updated when news comes out in the future. Speaking of the future, considering September is the month of going back to school, let's have a look at a couple of stories which we're likely to run into in the coming school year. Alex, where should we start?
Well, it's about that time where we talk about workload again. As we've just seen an announcement of the 14 sector leaders who will make up the DfE's Workload Reduction Task Force, as well as a promise by the department to deliver a flexible working toolkit for schools by the end of September, including information on ideas such as job shares, part-time working, and personal days.
The task force came as part of the deal cut by the government with the education unions to end the strikes that we covered at length earlier this year, with the ambition to cut 5 hours off the working week for teachers and school leaders over the next 3 years. To make this a reality, we'll also see an update to the DfE's 2019 flexible working guidance to be published sometime in winter 2023.
Quite a few of the members of the task force have also graced the stage at the Schools and Academies show, including Cassie Buchanan, Emma Knights, and former podcast guest Steve Rollett. I'm sure many more of them will be joining us at some point in the future. If you want to read the full list so you can start to get your hopes up, we'll include a link in the description.
While many are welcoming the task force with open arms, many still have their reservations over whether this will lead to meaningful change. Speaking with Schools Week, the Ask School General Secretary Jeff Barton mentioned that they are sceptical whether there is will in the government to actually take the steps that are required to produce systemic change, citing that underfunding of the system was a leading cause of high levels of workload.
This lines up with the findings of the Flexible Working in Schools report the Department for Education had commissioned in January 2023, which found that it was the cost of flexible working that continued to hinder its implementation.
This perhaps might be the reason why Stephen Morales, Chief Executive of the Institute of School Business Leadership, said that he could not understand why no school business or finance leaders were part of the task force, calling the decision symptomatic of a lack of joined-up thinking.
Morales has said that he will be reaching out to the DfE to offer the Institute support in the task force, so we'll be sure to keep our eyes on this one.
Our next story to keep your eyes on is, ironically, one that was hard to get your eyes on in the first place, as it involves a deal done silently around cutting the number of SEND programmes.
The Observer revealed that the government had signed a contract targeting 20% cuts in the number of new education plans for children with special educational needs and disabilities, with the then Junior Education Minister, Claire Cortinho, recently promoted to the Cabinet as Energy Secretary, subsequently telling MPs that no targets were in place.
Councils across England are currently grappling with huge financial deficits on SEND budgets due to a combination of rising demand for provision and continued underfunding. Part of the government's response to solve this problem was launching the Delivering Better Value in SEND programme, which supports councils to help bring down their SEND budget deficits through measures such as early intervention and teaching children with special needs in mainstream schools.
The Department for Education signed a contract with the consultancy firm Newton Europe back in 2022 to develop the DBV programme with one of the listed impacts of the programme being a reduction of at least 20% of the number of EHCPs, or education, health and care plans, as they're known in full.
EHCPs set out the education provision that children with significant needs must receive by law, though cash-strapped councils do often fail to meet these requirements. Recent years have seen rising numbers of new EHCPs being issued. This is for a plethora of reasons, including failings in the children's mental health system, non-inclusive approaches adopted by results-driven mainstream schools, and improved identification of special needs.
EHCPs usually provide specialist provision, which obviously don't come cheap, and as a result of the rising EHCP caseload mean the higher costs for councils, who are already often strapped for cash, especially with government funding not keeping up pace. As a result, ministers and council bosses are looking for ways to reduce case numbers, which has sparked fears that some children may not receive the care or provision they need.
Speaking to The Guardian, Julian Doherty from the campaign group Send Action stressed that this action was simply kicking the can down the road and passing the funding problem onto mainstream schools, who are already facing their own financial struggles.
In a response, a DfE spokesperson said, "It is completely wrong to suggest that the department is withdrawing support for children and young people with SEND. The DBV programme aims to help local authorities provide more effective SEND services by meeting the needs of children and young people at an early stage and with the right level of support. Naturally, we'd expect to see a reduction in the number of EHCPs issued as the children's needs are met earlier."
Well, I'm sure we could dig deeper and deeper into this forever, but I'm afraid for now we're out of time. Time to plug SAS.
Well, we're only a couple of months away, if that, from the Schools and Academy Show Birmingham at the NEC Birmingham on the 22nd of November, where you'll be able to see speakers like Bridget Phillipson, Simon Kidwell, President of the National Association of Head Teachers, and Christopher Russell, HMI, National Director for Education at Ofsted.
Make sure you book your place now, and we can't wait to see you there. But until next month, it's goodbye from me.
And that's goodbye from me.